This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Colonel Jim Hall of the U.S. Air Force, and his wife Minnie Mae Hall is also on the line with us. Today's date is the 16th of May, 2005. I am in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech, and Jim and Minnie Mae are joining me by telephone from their home in Fort Worth. Good afternoon to both of you again.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
And thank you for finding time to continue the interview. I'm sorry we're not doing it in person, but we'll have just as much fun and I think make good progress today. Jim, you had worked on some notes that you thought you might include in the record here, and I invite you to go ahead and include those if you will.
Surely. But before we officially start our interview on my Vietnam experiences, may I express my feelings about the military and Vietnam conflict?
Yes, sir.
I have over 30 years of active duty military service, including enlisted and officer assignments. I have never regretted a single day of that service, including 3 combat tours and being away from my family for about 6 years on various assignments on which they were not allowed to accompany me. As to my feelings about Vietnam, I fully supported our attempt to quell the spread of communism throughout Southeast Asia. The conflict in Vietnam is too politically controlled to allow us a total victory in Vietnam, and our withdrawal put a stamp on national indecisions on our actions. Nevertheless, with the actions we did take, communism has not spread into other countries in that area, and I attribute our Vietnam actions to that success. I should also note that I did not have to fight in the trenches, as so many of our valiant servicemen did, so I may not have the same perspective that many do have. On my first tour, I flew 55 combat missions, and on my second tour, I flew 96 combat missions, but I had a good bed to come back to each night, good meals, and no fear that the enemy might attack our base. So perspectives do vary depending on certain conditions. I'll begin by my assignment, Task Force Alpha, in Nha Nam Phnom Royal Thai Air Base. I reported there in November 1968, and reported to General John Dias, who was the commander of TFA. I entered as a lieutenant colonel, initially as deputy director of operations, and eventually as director of operations when that spot became open. TFA had the largest computer system in Southeast Asia, taking info from many varied sources, both air and ground, pertaining to North Vietnam movements both in the North and Laos. Intelligence reports were collected from Special Ops Ground Forces, Forward Air Controllers, 7th Airborne and Control Center Orbits, and EC-121 airplanes. All of this data had to be processed by the largest computer complex under IBM contract in Southeast Asia and forwarded to 7th Air Force Headquarters and Tonsonut Air Base in Saigon each morning by 5 a.m. After collation of all this data, I had to prepare the report for General Dice's approval and transmission. 7th Air Force would use this data for the master operations order for their air units in Vietnam and Thailand. We also had a division of high technical personnel who continuously researched new ideas for possible implementation in assessing the buildups, movements, and preparations of the North Vietnamese. One such involvement was assisting in the advancement of using laser-guided bombs and other highly classified functions. We had a C-47 assigned for our movement of personnel about Thailand and South Vietnam for coordination of operations and understanding mission complexities of the air operations units. I also frequently flew General Dice to Bangkok for meetings at the U.S. Embassy, and Tan Sanut to 7th Air Force Headquarters, meeting with 7th Air Force Commander General David Jones, who, if I remember correctly, became Chief of Staff of the Air Force at a later date.
Mm-hmm.
Back to intelligence and information gathering. Through these sources, we would get information about the location of North Vietnamese missile sites. There was a wing of F-105s at a base in Thailand, nicknamed the Missile Busters, with call signs of Wild Weasel. These specially equipped planes with their radar and missiles would be alerted to approximate location of enemy missile sites and airborne when the B-52 and other airstrikes were scheduled. When the missile sites came up on their radar to launch a missile, these Wild Weasels would home in on the site and try to destroy it. The North Vietnamese would move these sites frequently, so it was somewhat of a cat-and-mouse game, and as these sites would move, we would try to keep abreast of the new locations. One of our requirements was to lay strings of acoustic and seismic sensors in the predetermined locations along the so-called Ho Chi Minh Trail and other identified locations to determine movement of vehicles, movements we have determined vehicles, personnel, and other supply methods. After our analysis of such movements, we would determine the best location to lay these sensors. We had designated F-4 and C-130 units equipped for this mission. Wing numbers and locations of the C-130s is forgotten, but the F-4s were stationed at Ubon Royal Thai Air Base in Thailand,
mm-hmm.
south of Nha Tham Phanom along the Mekong River.
Mm-hmm.
When our sensors would detect movements, we would call in strike aircraft with exact movement location for their bombing efforts. We could monitor the success of these bombing missions by the sensor information. It was almost instantaneous. These missions were quite successful, and we would replant sensors if they were damaged or lost their battery power. I might blow my whistle here a bit. General Dice called me in one day and told me I had just been promoted to full colonel. He also told me that I was the most well-versed, knowledgeable, and personnel-oriented lieutenant colonel he had ever encountered in his career, including several colonel-level wing commanders who served under him. Perhaps this endorsement on my annual evaluation report reflected that and led to my promotion to colonel. After General Dice left, we got a brigadier general named Butcher, Chester, I believe, first name,
mm-hmm.
who was an I and me man, making decisions contrary to established policies and getting into trouble with 7th Air Force headquarters. No one could please him. I think he had probably been one of the colonel wing commanders that General Dice mentioned. I have no idea how he ever made general. Thank goodness I left after about 2 months under his command. Later, when I was stationed at England Air Force Base, Louisiana, an OSI agent came to me and questioned me about a lot of General Butcher's actions while in Nha Tham Phanom. I didn't give the general a very good report, and that was the last I ever heard of him. Other than this last comment, I believe that our operation at Task Force Alpha helped reduce the resupply efforts of the North Vietnamese, their efforts in the South. But again, I feel that politics precluded the eventual defeat of the North's efforts to overrun the South. Without that intrusion, I believe the conflict would have ended in our favor. I must note that we had two exceptionally highly classified missions that required a special security clearance above top secret. They were nicknamed Alfredo and the Slinging Dart. Very few of our people even knew about them.
Wait, what was the name of the second one again, Jim?
Slinging Dart.
Slinging Dart.
D-A-R-T.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Very few of our people ever knew about them. I don't know whether they have been declassified even today, so I can't go into detail.
Okay.
I flew 55 combat missions this tour, including the old C-47, several different forward air controllers, and EC-121 and F-4. And then I was to be assigned to England Air Force Base upon completion of the tour there.
Mm-hmm.
And after leaving Task Force Alpha, I was assigned as the Deputy Base Commander at England Air Force Base, moving as Base Commander when the current commander was transferred. This was a tactical air command base with an F-100 wing. The wing commander was another of these colonels, General Dice mentioned, and I, me type, without much experience except flying airplanes. We got along except in some of his decisions, which were against Air Force policy. When I would advise him of such, he would say, "We can do it this way," and we got in trouble a couple of times with the Air Force Inspector General's visits.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't enjoy being around fighter pilots with their wild parties and drinking, but continued to operate the base in a progressive manner. One occasion which really turned me off was an order issued to me by the wing commander in the officers' club one day. He had a nice club, and he said to me, "Jim, there is one thing lacking. We need a fireplace in that corner over there," pointing to a corner in the bar. I said, "Colonel, we have a nice fireplace in the dining room, and this area is well heated in the winter." His reply was, "Yes, but these pilots don't have a place to throw and break their drink glasses after giving a toast." I said, "I'd have it built only with a definitive written order." The order never came, but that was the level of his thinking. Mm-hmm. Just do it without any real necessity. After having been there about 6 months, the colonel's assignment branch in the Pentagon called me one day and asked if I would like an assignment as chief of the air mission in Managua, Nicaragua. I told them I had only been back from Vietnam a short time and did not relish another overseas assignment so soon. About a month later, another call. "How would you like to be the air attaché in Israel?" Then later, "How about the assistant air attaché in Moscow?" And still later, "How about the air attaché in Nigeria?" I think it was Nigeria. It was an African nation.
Mm-hmm.
And my answer was the same. But I talked to Minnie Mae, my wife, about this, saying they're asking me if, with emphasis on if, I would like so-and-so. But at about the end of a year at England, they would probably come to me and say that your next assignment is such and such.
Sure.
Minnie Mae said what I told her I knew to assign. Minnie Mae said,
"What did I say?"
Minnie Mae said, "What would I do?"
Yeah.
During that year, I told her I knew two assignments for colonels in Vietnam and might volunteer for one of those and would never have to go overseas again. She said again, "What will I do?" I said, "Both of our children are out on their own and your widowed mother is contemplating a move to a new city and you could enjoy a year with her and help her move." After some serious discussions, we agreed on my volunteer suggestion. I called the colonel's branch and ordered a volunteer for one of the two jobs. Their response was, "We don't get many volunteers. We'll get back to you," and they did in about a week.
Mm-hmm.
Later, with an assignment as an orbit commander in the 7th Airborne Command and Control Center at Udorn, Thailand. We left England Air Force Base in September 1971. I have always suspected the reason I was getting called about the air mission and attaché assignments was because of my assignment in the Air Force Technical Application Center, where I dealt with embassies, consulates, high-level U.S. and foreign civilian and military officials, and having been a member of our air staff.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So much for the England Air Force Base assignment. Now to the 7th Airborne Command Control Center in Thailand. So it is off to Thailand I go in September 1971. But first there must be a stop at Clark Air Force Base near Manila, Philippine Islands, to attend an escape, evasion, and survival course before I can fly combat missions. This is commonly called Snake School, with a week of classroom instruction, then 3 days in the field with implementation of supervised activities we had learned in class. Then we returned loose in a jungle to try to evade capture by hired indigenous natives who would be paid to capture us. If we were caught three times, we failed the course and had to start over. I got caught once, which was less than most. However, I never did see a snake, but saw plenty of rats. Ugh. Upon arrival at Udorn, Royal Thai Air Force Base, Thailand, on the northern Mekong River, I was given a classified organizational briefing, instructed in operation procedures, sent to 7th Air Force Headquarters in Saigon to become familiar with the interconnection of our operations with their plans and requirements. Then back to ABCCC and assigned as Orbit Commander of Cricket Orbit. 7th ABCCC mission was to control and coordinate all strike missions against the North Vietnamese with two orbits manned 24 hours a day. One orbit over northern Laos above the Plain of George, and the other in southern Laos near the Cambodian and South Vietnamese borders. These orbits were flown in specially equipped C-130 airplanes. The control function was handled by six specially trained air controllers and an intelligence officer. The northern orbit was operated by a daytime orbit designated Cricket, which would stay on station until relieved after 12 hours by another C-130 night orbit called Alley Cat. In the southern orbit, the daytime orbit was designated Hillsborough, with the nighttime orbit being Moonbeam. There was another C-130 mission named Trump, which was very highly classified, and I doubt that that mission has been declassified. Okay. The air controllers would receive calls from all strike aircraft originating from Thailand bases and would advise them to of any other aerial activity in their area of operation. The Navy also operated from their carriers and controlled their own missions. One of our air controllers was in constant communication with the Navy, equivalent of 7ABCCC, to preclude conflict in airstrike areas. Two other of our controllers were in constant communication with forward air controllers, accepting their need for airstrikes and forwarding information to the strike aircraft. The intelligence officer was in contact with strike aircraft. Was in contact with special operations groups on the ground in Laos, accepting any information they might have for immediate strikes or further transmission to 7th Air Force in Saigon for immediate for other necessary action. In the northern orbit, Cricket and Alley Cat, the intelligence officer would also be in contact with Laotian General Vang Pao's operations people to coordinate their ground policies, artillery, and aerial activities to assure there was no conflict between our activities and theirs. I visited General Vang Pao twice in Long Tin to coordinate our joint operations. I was also sent to the Plain of Jars to coordinate artillery activities. Very interesting and effective operations in northern Laos in an attempt to preclude the North Vietnamese and Pathet Lao forces from overriding North Laos from the northeast. In April 1971, our operation was moved on to Korat in central Thailand. I might add here that I was able to take 2 weeks leave at this time, and Minnie Mae came to visit me for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. The main purpose was to celebrate her 50th birthday. I gave her a grand tour of portions of Thailand that I knew except Nak Ong Phanom, which was strictly no unauthorized visitors. After a few days in Bangkok, showing her that wonderful city and celebrating our joint birthdays on April 8th, her 50th and my 53rd, we then flew to Udorn, visiting Thai friends there, with a grand tour of that area, then to Chiang Mai, northwestern Thailand, where the Chinese and Burma, now Myanmar, borders. On a few previous in on a few previous weekend flights into Chiang Mai, I had become friends with a manufacturer of teak furniture and artifacts. He knew a great taxi driver who I could hire for the full weekend, and he would show me the countryside. I hired John, a taxi driver, to show me the mail of the area around Chiang Mai. Tony the Teak Man and his wife were gracious hosts for an elegant dinner and our guests for another.
Mm-hmm.
Then we caught an overnight train back to Bangkok for another couple of days before I had returned to duty at Korat. Minnie Mae shared my trailer home for a week while I flew a couple of combat missions. Then back to Bangkok and the U.S. she went. A great opportunity for both of us. During this tour, I flew 96 combat missions and logged just over 1,000 combat flying hours. This assignment was a great pleasure, but again, I must reiterate that we could have done a better job of winning the overall conflict if we had been allowed to make more airstrikes on very important targets in North Vietnam, especially in Hanoi and Haiphong areas. I left Thailand in early September 1972 for an assignment to Hill Air Force Base, Utah, as the deputy base commander. Then to Hill Air Force Base, which is near Ogden, Utah, about 50 miles north of Salt Lake City. It was one of five huge Air Force depots, which were the supply sources for all Air Force needs. These depots were called Air Logistics Centers under the Air Force Logistics Command. Major General Bryce Poe was the Logistics Center commander when I arrived. He was the very best boss I ever had in the Air Force. I arrived at Hill as Deputy Air Base Commander and was elevated to Base Commander upon retirement of the then Base Commander. Hill Air Force Base covered approximately 6,000 acres of ground with a multitude of large warehouses, several large airplane hangars, a Titan II inverted missile silo deep in the ground. The Air Logistics Center, a base hospital, a helicopter rescue wing, the Air Force Reserve fighter group, and several other tenants. In addition, we had over 500 base housing units for military personnel and many on-base dormitories for unmarried personnel. The missile silo was for research and further development of the Titan II missile. The air warehouses were crammed with several thousand items needed throughout the Air Force and were specifically designated through our logistics center. The center was also designated supplier of all Air Force aircraft landing gear needs, also being the repair depot for such. It was a prime depot for all F-16 needs and depot repairs. During my tenure, we automated all the warehouses so that a computerized operation selected the appropriate request and delivered it over designated moving tracks to the appropriate shipping department. We also envisioned a museum commemorating the contributions the base had made to the area, along with many artifacts from its beginning in World War II, along with many restored U.S. Air Force airplanes. This has now become a reality as a Hill Aerospace Museum. The base was outstandingly supported by all local cities, chambers of commerce, the state legislature, the Mormon Church headquarters, and innumerable named organizations and support groups. I was elected as a member of several organizational boards, such as chambers of commerce, advertising agencies, and one local bank. I suppose the bank was appreciative of the approximate $500 million annual payroll we had. This was generated by the 21,000 civilian employees and 6,000 military personnel on the base for which me and my staff were responsible to assure proper working conditions, dining facilities, health care, housing for military, and recreation. All of this constituted a $4 billion inventory of physical property, supplies, and invested assessments from earned non-governmental sources. In addition to Hill Air Force Base, we also had the Wendover bombing range up about 1 million acres and an auxiliary airfield thereon for which I was responsible. One interesting incident came as a result of the annual prayer breakfast the President had encouraged for all military bases.
Mm-hmm.
At the February 1974 breakfast, I invited President Kimball of the Church of Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons,
mm-hmm.
to be our guest speaker. He graciously accepted and brought his military liaison, Apostle Boyd Packer, along. It was a memorable occasion to hear such a highly respected religious leader speak. Later, I received a letter from Boyd Packer's assistant, David Haight, citing an invitation from President Kimball to a visit to their headquarters complex in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
This invitation also included my entire base chaplain staff of 10 chaplains. We were really treated royally with a very depth of understanding of the LDS religion, royally, and a very depth of understanding of, I'm repeating myself. We were really treated royally with a very depth of understanding of the LDS religion without any attempt to convert us.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful tour through the headquarters, including a session of their missionary training program, and a special conducted tour through the attic and normally unseen portions of their tabernacle. Excellent rapport.
Mm-hmm.
Just prior to my departure from Hill, we broke ground for over 200 more base housing units, a major accomplishment with the Congress cutting military spending for 1974. My departure was sad for me, for my assignment there was the best duty I served in my career. AFTAC was wonderful, but Hill was better, as I had so much responsibility and was able to accomplish a lot for the future of the base. Notwithstanding, I asked General Poe if he might find me an assignment near the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. My stepmother had recently passed away, and my 85-year-old father couldn't take care of himself, no home health in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And Minnie Mae would fly there every other week to look in on him and prepare him for another 2 weeks before she would return. General Poe was very sympathetic. He said he had a similar situation with his father a few years ago. So after a couple of weeks, General Poe told me he could get me an assignment as Inspector General at the Air Logistics Center at Tinker Air Force Base, Oklahoma City. I accepted, as that was just over 200 miles from Dallas-Fort Worth and easier to look in on Dad. Thus, we were transferred to Tinker Air Force Base in September 1974. I reported to Tinker in late September as the Inspector General for the Air Logistics Center. However, General Jim Randolph told me it would be temporary as the then Air Base Commander would retire in a few months and I would become the base commander. The Inspector General was somewhat blah. Yep, blah. Besides inspections of several operations on base, he was flooded with individual complaints that took a lot of time to resolve, and about 80% were not substantiated. And the civil service union was very strong, leaving the production rate quite a bit below our goals. Not like Hill, where 74% of the base population was Mormon with outstanding work ethics and no problems at all.
Mm-hmm.
I made a few civilian employees angry with me because of the pressure to improve their performance. The base commander retired, and I took over as base commander. With my previous working as Inspector General, my assignment was exactly popular with a lot of people and disconcerting to me in my attempt to improve working conditions and productions among my staff, which was about 50% civilians.
Mm-hmm.
But as at Hill, I worked hard to fulfill my responsibilities and please General Randolph, so it went pretty well. However, in mid-July of 1975, Minnie Mae and I took a two-week vacation without our grown children or one of our mothers, as we usually did. Driving back to Oklahoma, I said, you know, I could take a whole lot of this life, kind of life, and retirement would offer it. We talked about it and decided that that would be our plan. Upon return to duty the following Monday morning, I saw General Randolph and told him I was putting in my request for retirement. He said, Jim, please don't do that. I like the way you operate. I told him I was sorry, but the decision had been made, and I initiated the necessary action that day. Consequently, on September the 1st, 1975, I retired from the Air Force with 30 years, 7 months of active duty, and 4 years in the Air Force Reserves between the end of World War II and my recall to duty for the Korean conflict of 1950. My actual retirement started in Granbury, Texas. Granbury is a quaint little town. Do you want to hear all this?
I sure do, please. Absolutely.
You haven't gone to sleep yet.
No. Actually, I'm very busy taking notes.
Granbury is a quaint little town about 35 miles of Fort Worth, west of Fort Worth.
Mm-hmm.
It was established in the mid-1980s while Indian tribes were still prominent in the area, but it survived and became the county seat of Hood County. It was surrounded by cotton, grain, and peanut crops, its major economic base, also some cattle resources. It survived the Depression, but after many years began to regress economically, and by 1970, about one-third of the buildings on the square were empty. Many boarded up, and some with roofs caved in. But it was surrounded by the Brazos River, and the U.S. Civil Engineers had just completed a dam south of Granbury, and Lake Granbury was formed. At that time, Hood County had about 6,000 people, and the city had 2,700 residents. The original land for the county seat was donated by two brothers named Nutt, who were quite popular in the area and had established a general store on one corner off the proposed square before the courthouse was built.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, many other merchants and professionals built around the square. Two of the Nutt grandchildren had left the little town in their early adulthood, made their millions in the Dallas area, and saw the potential future of the quaint little town as a tourist attraction with the new lake. They returned, bought up several of the empty stores on the square, renovated them, and started business therein. The town did become a tourist attraction and began to prosper again. While I was on my second assignment to Vietnam, and Minnie Mae was in Glen Rose, Texas, where her mother had moved, the two of them would frequently go to Granbury to shop, eat, and enjoy the quaint atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Minnie Mae fell in love with Granbury, so we decided to test it and see if it was where we would really be happy in retirement. We put all of our household goods in storage, rented an apartment a half block off the square, bought a limited amount of Goodwill and garage sale furnishings, and set up housekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
After a couple of months, having joined the Methodist Church on one corner of the square and meeting a lot of the merchants and other nice people, we decided this was a place we could be happy. So we bought two residential lots with direct access to the lake, only 6 blocks from the square, on which we would build our 3,000-square-foot, 4-bedroom, 3-bath, living room, dining room, den, kitchen, breakfast room, bar, 2 garage, workshop, and beautiful landscaping, which we did ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, the local newspaper noted that the city manager had retired and the city council was advertising for a new one. Minnie Mae said, you ran large air bases you could do this job, why don't you apply? I stated I was required and didn't relish going back to work. She kept pushing me, so I submitted my resume, was interviewed by the mayor and council, was hired, and started to work. The city financial situation was pretty poor, so I began to search out the problems and correcting deficiencies, getting us back to a sustainable operating situation. I was really enjoying the job when I detected two flagrant violations of Texas state laws. One involved personal property law, not land or buildings, and the other involved annexation of land for residential development. As to the latter, Texas law is quite strict on how land annexation can be approved by city councils. The mayor was a land developer and had convinced the council to allow him to annex one house plat at a time contiguous to a section of the city limits, a direct violation of state law. I went to the mayor and told him what I had found. He told me to sit on it until the forthcoming election. We discussed it back and forth with no resolution, so I left. The next morning, I went to his office with a resignation letter justifying my position as having hired to uphold the federal and state laws and the ordinances of the city. He saw my letter and said, I hope this is not what I think it is. I said I would stay on until they could find someone else, so I left that job after only 5 months. The council, the city council was upset and tried to get me to remain, but I was out of there. However, they then asked me to campaign for a forthcoming open city council seat. I was elected and served 3 terms with a new mayor. I really enjoyed that stint of elected public service and without being tied down with a morning 7 a.m. until job. I was free to become active in many civic, charity, club, and church activities. Likewise, many may also became quite involved in like activities, becoming president of a prestigious Women's Wednesday Club, which had been organized around the turn of the century, president of the only local garden club, and many boards and guilds of various organizations. We had made our home and wanted to use some of the leadership qualities we had developed over our many years of experiences elsewhere. After living there for about 3 years, Minnie Mae's mother became ill and spent her last 4 years as a complete invalid in our home. My mother was in a Granbury nursing home, and my dad was in a Dallas nursing home, so many hours were devoted to their care until their death between 1982 and 1986. These were great losses to us, but we overcame our grieving and went on with our active life. During our unencumbered periods of retired life, we did considerable traveling by car. We visited every one of the 254 counties of Texas, taking a photo of the courthouses, all 50 of the United States, and extended driving tours through all of the southern provinces of Canada, from the Eastern Maritimes to Vancouver Island in the west. Then we became addicted to ocean paddle boat steamer cruises on the Mississippi River complex and the Western Columbia River. As I approached 7 years old, I could see that I would not be able to maintain our wonderful home in Granbury, and potential health problems might need more specialized treatment that was not available there. Plus, if Minnie Mae or I should get down health-wise, it would be a strain on our daughter to commute down there from home in Colleyville, a Fort Worth suburb. So we began to think about moving into a retirement community in a Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex. We did a lot of research of such facilities, and in November 1989, we purchased a condominium in the Lakewood Village Retirement Community in East Fort Worth. It has 3 levels of care: independent living, where we bought into, assisted living complex, and a skilled nursing home, nurse care facility. So we feel we will be ready for the future. Plus, we only live about 15 minutes from our daughter. As we were leaving Granbury, there were many festive events wishing us farewell and good luck in our new lifestyle. Many accolades that we never expected. To toot our whistle, here is the wording of one plaque presented to us by the Hood County News, the local newspaper distributed three times a week.
Mm-hmm.
The one-inch printed heading reads, Good for Hood, Hood being Hood County.
Mm-hmm.
Followed by, for dedicated service in their community, they should be in the Hall of Fame in three-quarter-inch letters. Then these words, some people live in the world to serve others. Jim and Minnie Mae Hall, Granbury's ambassadors of goodwill, are two such people. During their 14 years here, their volunteer efforts have helped a countless number of individuals and about as many community projects. One would be hard-pressed to name another couple who has done more for Granbury. Unfortunately, the Halls will be moving away in a couple of weeks to a Fort Worth retirement community. First thing about son and daughter, the Halls went to be prepared if a serious health problem strikes. They explained, we want to prepare ourselves for older age before infirmities possibly set in. The Halls are deeply involved in this community, and the townspeople developed them. They were named Citizens of the Year by the prestigious Women's Wednesday Club in 1987. They'll be sorely missed in our community as they leave, ending with half-inch letters, Thanks, Jim and Minnie Mae. So we left Granbury and moved into our new condominium apartment in Fort Worth in November 1989. I'm getting close to the end.
You keep going, Jim.
How's your tape?
It's in good shape.
It's rolling. So what do we do now that we have no homeowner responsibilities? We have a cafeteria where we receive one meal daily included in our monthly maintenance fee and have no meetings to attend other than commitments.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we just began all over again with homeowner leadership roles, civic activity, local clubs, and our new church.
Mm-hmm.
I became president of our residence council, a board member of the Lakewood Village Condominium Homeowners Association, and deeply involved in getting a Fort Worth Regional Library built in our immediate area. Minnie Mae became president of the Village Book Review Club, chairman of the Food Service Committee, and established a Woman's Red Hat Group.
Mm-hmm.
She is Mrs. Sunshine with her outgoing and wonderful personality in greeting new residents and encouraging our old residents about their aches and pains. This is a good life, and as we previously stated, we just lock our door and go, either on a planned trip or on a spur-of-a-moment opportunity. As of this date, in May 2005, we've been on 20 ocean cruises to most parts of the world, having completed a full around-the-world vacation, and have sailed on paddle wheel steamboats on the Mississippi complex four times, and one time on the Columbia River in the Oregon, Washington, Idaho area, a total of 25 cruises. We're beginning to feel our old age at ages of 86 and 83 with various aches and pains and a few other minor problems, but medication take care of that so we continue an active life.
Mm-hmm.
Our next planned trip will be to a 19th Bomb Group reunion later this year in San Antonio. I look forward to seeing some of my old World War II buddies, as well as old newer guys from the Vietnam era and a couple of newer ones from Desert Storm and the Iraq efforts. I've enjoyed working with Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archives at Texas Tech University and presenting some of my memories about my life in general and about my military career. In this endeavor, it has taxed my memory in many areas, and I have rambled along as various incidents reveal themselves, but I hope this will be worthwhile to the archives and anyone who might stumble across it, as it is preserved for future reference, if any. I am Jim Hall. Thank you.
Jim, thank you very much for all the effort that you put into developing that statement and, of course, all the time that you both have spent with us. Just for listeners' information, Jim and Minnie may have agreed to answer a few questions or to at least consider them and think about what they might reply. And if you're all right, Jim, we'll go ahead and I'll ask you a couple of questions.
Okay.
Okay. Jim, thinking back over your career, what was your favorite plane to fly? What was the best aircraft you ever flew?
Well, I would have to say two, but two totally different mission-capable airplanes.
Okay.
My favorite one, I guess, was the B-29 in World War II, a combat-type airplane, because it was so highly technically advanced for those days, and I had a cohesive crew that I flew with on each of the 35 missions I flew over Japan, so that made it real special to me. But coming on up into the more modern era, I flew the B-52, which was a great airplane, easy to fly, and could accomplish a great mission. And then there was a little T-39, which was an offspring of a North American civilian version Sabreliner, and it could carry about 7 passengers. And I loved to fly it. That's basically what I flew during my assignment in Germany for 3 years, and I flew it throughout quite a bit of all over Europe and for Northern Africa and into the Mideast countries, not too far in the Mideast. I guess Turkey would probably be the farthest in the Mideast, but it was a wonderful little airplane.
What was the best thing about it?
Pleasantry in flying. Just so easy to fly. It was very well appointed as a little passenger airplane, not cargo. And I called it the Cadillac of the Air Force.
Jim, if you don't mind, I want to ask you a couple of questions about the service that you gave to the country during your tours in Southeast Asia.
Okay.
First of all, with Task Force Alpha and the first tour, can you tell me a little bit about this first generation of laser-guided bombs that you used? How did you get familiar with them? Did you go to briefings, and how effective were they?
Here is my only involvement, very minor. As I mentioned, we had this highly technical division under the Director of Operations, which I was.
Yes.
And at a C-130 base, and I don't know where it was now, they were trying to drop bombs with a laser beam. And they were having a lot of trouble. And they somehow contacted us and asked if we had a specialist who might know something about such a process and could be of assistance to them. And fortunately, we did. I don't remember his name. He was Lieutenant Colonel, and he volunteered to go and work with them. And it didn't get to the degree near where we are today, but they got to where they could come pretty close to the target by just dropping the bomb out of a C-130 and following a laser path.
Okay.
But
am I right in describing those as basically the first generation?
Well, I'm not certain.
Okay.
But it was an early generation. I don't know if it was the first.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But it there might have been other. Well, there must have been other activities on it because they were trying to do it before we got involved.
Okay. So it actually predated your first tour in some ways.
Uh-huh. It was improved a bit by the assistance of this lieutenant colonel, but not near the precision that it has today.
What was the title of that technical division that was under you? That was
You know, I've tried to remember that.
Okay.
And I should have asked Lee Burt when I was talking to him a while back.
Well, I'll ask him when I interview him. How's that? Okay. Let me ask a little bit about other details from your second tour.
Okay.
In the paperwork that you provided us, you mentioned that you had been on two backseat missions over North Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
In an F-4.
Yes.
Can you tell me anything about those missions or what it's like to be in an F-4?
Well, we were on our AB-CCC organization was
mm-hmm.
on the base with an F-4 wing, and I became real familiar with the commander who eventually became chief of staff of the Air Force.
Yes.
Charles, I might think of before we hang up.
You had mentioned him earlier.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I never have been in an F-4. And you ever have an occasion when an airplane might go up and really didn't need a backseater? And he said, sure, I can arrange that, Jim. So I flew two reconnaissance, they were so-called reconnaissance missions, over the southern part of Vietnam. We didn't go up into the Gillett Park, where Hanoi and Haiphong and all were.
Over the southern part of North Vietnam.
In North Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Just probably, I don't know, maybe 100 miles north of the DMZ, in that general area.
Sure.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And just on a recce mission both times.
Were there any events during the mission that you remember? Either
no,
of those missions?
No. He just had automatic photo capability,
okay.
and he activated that, and I just sat there and rode and looked.
So
I handled stick a little bit, but not a lot.
A little bit, huh?
Mm-hmm.
How did that feel? How did that plane feel?
It was a great combat airplane. Didn't do very many maneuvers in it.
Mm-hmm.
We just he did most of the flying. I did very little, but it was just mostly straight and level flying, climbing out and get to his desired altitude and doing little recce work and then
mm-hmm.
heading back toward Udorn.
Well, Jim, you also mentioned that you had, in the course of that second tour, occasions on which you met General Vong Pao. Can you tell me the circumstances of those meetings, if you remember at all?
Yes. As I mentioned in this, and I can expand on it a bit,
mm-hmm.
General Vong Pao had a little Air Force of his own,
mm-hmm.
and if I'm remembering correctly, they were our Air Force trainers, T-28s, I believe.
I think that's right.
He had, and they flew on their own. I guess it's legal to mention it now. We had some civilianized Air Force instructors up there
mm-hmm.
to help them out. And General Vong Pao also controlled the ground forces and the artillery, which was basically out in the plain of jars, firing toward the east, toward the approaching Laotian Pathet Lao.
Mm-hmm.
And in conjunction with this, we would have our FAC airplanes, the U.S. FAC airplanes, sometime necessary to get up into that area to spot a specified target that had been reported to us by our U.S. Special Operations people. And it was necessary for all of the Laotian people to understand exactly what was going on and to coordinate with us and us with them on what was happening both in their airstrikes and in their artillery firings so that we would not be hurting them any.
Sure.
And them not hurting us any if we had a joint involvement in that general area. And General Vong Pao was very gracious, very understanding, and he says, you're helping us more than we're helping you. And we will do anything that will help you. And he, especially with his little fighter pilots, he said, we can control them easily.
Mm-hmm.
The artillery batteries, the ones I visited at least, were run by the Royal Thai Army people,
mm-hmm.
not the Vietnamese, not the Laotian people. And I went up a second time where we had had a minor violation by one of the fighter pilots interfering with one of our forward air controllers, and I went up a second time and just said hello to General Van Powell that I would go talk to his operations people about this and work something out.
Mm-hmm. What was your impression of him? You met him under two different kinds of circumstances. One, the second one sounds a little more pressed, a little more pressure there. Did he receive you graciously?
Oh yes, mm-hmm. Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
That ethnic culture that the Thai people have is very prominent in Laos also,
mm-hmm.
and they're very humble, very understanding, and very accommodating. And it was real easy to brief him and talk to him, and he concurred wholly with any proposal that we made. Real easy to work with.
Did he have U.S. Air Force personnel around him generally at all? As advisors?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
but to what level, I can't really...
Oh, sure.
I didn't really determine, but I know that they were so-called civilians,
mm-hmm.
but they were Air Force people on special assignment with a civilian.
Yes, sir, yes. Most of that is now pretty well known.
Yeah. But the... In fact, I think, if I remember correctly, they were called Raven Facts.
I think that's right. Yes, sir.
I think that.
I think they've even made a movie about them now.
I think so, yeah. But as far as high-level advisor on his staff, American high-level advisor, I don't know that he had that.
Minnie Mae, are you still listening in?
Yes, I am.
I wonder if I can ask a question of you. You were spending a great deal of time... in the U.S. during these two tours, I know, although you did visit Jim in Thailand, as he said, and went on that wonderful tour.
Mm-hmm.
What were you thinking about, and what was your reaction to the growing anti-Vietnam War climate in the U.S. during those years?
Well, I guess I really... defended our position as much as I could.
Okay.
If people were negative, I tried to say something positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in Glen Rose, when I stayed with my mother the year,
yes,
it's a small, small town, and the people there were not as probably vocal or as involved with it. They had people who were over there, of course. But I never did run into anyone that was not for what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
They were probably there, but they never bothered me about it.
But when you were watching, for example, the evening news and so forth, and you would see the commentaries and reports on
protests.
Yeah,
I did
protests.
All of that and cut out clippings of the paper and save those for him and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But
did it bother you?
Well, you know... Somebody asked me the other day, didn't I worry all the time?
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't. I think I watched my mother when she lost her two sons.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, there's not one thing we can do about it. And I'm trusting that whatever's going to be will be. And Jim is doing what he wants to do. And I just kind of didn't lose sleep over it. And... people might have thought I wasn't really caring, but I was.
Well, yes, that's a completely different thing, isn't it? I mean, how much you care isn't necessarily denoted by how much you worry.
Mm-hmm.
I might interject right
here. Yes, please.
Laura, her grandparents named Nichols and Steels. And you combine those two, and that's quite a strong alloy.
Absolutely. So. And she has given full demonstration of that in these interviews. And
her mother and she were made of the same alloy, and they withstood such things greatly.
Yeah, well, I tell you, of course I was inside, I was worried.
Sure.
But, I realize worry doesn't really help much.
Did you?
And I try to keep a cheerful outlook and look on the bright side of everything.
Well,
Pollyanna.
Well, but the two of you often discussed, it sounds like, what the next move would be. You were on board with his decision to volunteer
we
for a second.
We always have. Uh-huh. We've always discussed everything.
Yeah, and I think that's just wonderful and a great lesson to people now. Some of that seems to be missing.
Well, thank you.
Let me ask Jim a little bit about the period when you were at Hill Air Force Base. I mean, you've described in detail the work of the base and your roles there. But, of course, there were very, very important developments during that time period that affected Southeast Asia. And in particular, I'm thinking about the Paris peace agreements and the release of the POWs. Do you remember that in early 1973?
The only thing, you're talking about the release of the prisoners in Iran?
The prisoner, U.S. prisoners being held in Hanoi.
Oh, in Vietnam,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
The only thing I wasn't involved in anything concerning it.
No.
The only thing I saw was what came through the television newspapers and our daily report from generated in Air Force headquarters. It was teletyped out to us, so just very minor summary of everything. But we didn't at where we were. We didn't have any involvement in it.
Right. How did you feel though, as someone who had served over there and all kinds of Air Force guys getting released? And did you think the agreement was a good one to conclude the war? Do you think that the timing was right and the agreement was a solid one, or not so much?
It was long overdue, and to go back before the agreement, as I kind of emphasized, I think if the politics had stayed out of it and given us given the goal to the military, the Department of Defense, as to what we were to accomplish over there, and basically turn it over to them without all the decisions being made in, as I understand, basically in Lyndon Johnson's office and McNamara's office, that things would have turned out a lot better. We wouldn't have had our guys pinned up so long there in as prisoners, and I think that the agreement would have been much stronger in our favor if we'd had more pressure on the Hanoi and Haiphong area to really show the Vietnamese that they didn't have a chance to win if they continued the war, and that we hoped that they would get rid of their communist leanings. But I think as it turned out, I'm happy that the agreement came along as it did, when it did, with all the other factors that I've said not being a factor.
Right, lots of other things kind of coming together. Did you feel the same way about President Nixon's management of the war that you've come to feel about President Johnson's?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm.
He was a little too powerful. He felt he had to be too involved.
Yes, and should have left it to the Defense Department.
Well, more or less, set a goal. And naturally, he has a final say. But I think the way that we're working today is a good example of the way we should work with Iraq, the way we should work in Vietnam. President Bush is very strong, very involved in operations, but he's turned it basically over to his military, to the Department of Defense and his military commanders in Rumsfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what should have been done in Vietnam.
I see. Mm-hmm. Do you remember any strong reaction when you heard in 1975 that all of South Vietnam was falling to communist control?
Yes, I did, especially in the military.
Uh-huh.
Very upset that we could be there as long as we did, lose as many lives as we lost, and then give it away like we did.
Did you have a sense that, or do you have a sense now that we lost that conflict, or is there more to it than a simple pronouncement like that?
We lost the conflict, but we won, in my mind, the effort to preclude the spread of communism beyond the Vietnamese borders. Cambodia, as you well know, still has a communist factor there, but if there had not, I feel, if there had not been an action against the North Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
that Thailand would probably have been overrun,
mm-hmm.
as Laos has been. And then Laos is, I guess, what, partially communist right now. They're
mm-hmm.
not fully free yet.
Have you been back to Southeast Asia? You mentioned that you had gone on a round-the-world trip in addition to all of the miles that you've logged here in North America. Have you been back to Asia at all?
Just the one trip that we mentioned where we flew into Singapore.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
We're taking a trip of what's called the Spice Islands, which is Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
And our first stop, then we got on, after 4 days in Singapore, we got on a cruise ship. And the first stop was Phuket, Thailand, which is way down south in the panhandle of
yes.
Thailand. Mm-hmm. And just a little bit east of the northern tip of the big island of Sumatra in the Indonesia complex, where the tsunami occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so far removed from, Phuket is so far removed from the area that I served in that it was just really a resort area.
Mm-hmm. Was it recognizable to you as Thailand, though?
Was what?
Was it recognizable as Thailand?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. The humble people and
mm-hmm.
and the friendly, the monks and their temples, and just like a miniature Bangkok, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you a question that this kind of overlays some of the comments that you provided earlier about your retirement and how much fun you two have had together, and how many good plans you've made and lived into. How do you feel in general about America's treatment of its veterans, including yourself, but more broadly? I mean, should the government do more than it has done, or are you fairly satisfied that the government is paying proper attention to the needs of veterans?
I have two feelings on that, Laura.
Mm-hmm.
One is the government has established good programs good programs for veterans in general. The Iraq thing has caused a big influx of more needs for more help for those guys who are coming back with lifelong-term injuries, missing limbs, that type of thing.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Which the government works with them on.
Mm-hmm.
My other feeling is that veterans before this conflict, the Iraqi conflict, a lot of them are expecting the government to do everything in the world for them. I talked to guys who were veterans who are living almost as good as I am, saying that, why doesn't the government take care of us better? We spend all our time doing this and that. and the other. Why don't the government do more for us? And I tell them, we are the government. How long can we continue to give, where the giving might not be essential? You would be happy to have it, but not really essential to sustain your livelihood. That's my general feeling, if that was clear enough for you.
So you have some concerns about the fiscal intelligence of broadening basically probably any government program, not just the veterans program. Is that the direction you're going in?
That's where I'm going.
Okay, yeah.
I think we, the people, expect, I'll rephrase, there are certain factions of we, the people, who think the government owes them everything. I can go back to the early days of Medicare. Medicare was developed to help people with medical problems, and it has expanded to cover so many other things that in some cases are absolutely not necessary, but they're convenient for people. And at my age and stage, seeing older people and a lot of their desires and, in some cases, needs, the government's just overspending. And in some, I won't attempt to identify the classes, but in some classes of our nation, of our people, the health care providers are easy to be influenced. I started to use the word bribes, but I won't use it. Influenced to prescribe, not medications necessarily, but other things that people that don't really need them get them, and that's a big cost to our economy.
Right, and that all has to be borne by someone.
That's us.
Yeah, absolutely.
We the people.
Well, I wonder whether either of you have any additional observations or things that I haven't asked you about that you feel you'd like to include in this interview.
I really can't think of anything, Laura. You've been so efficient in the way you've handled the questions.
Well, thank you, Minnie Mae.
I think you covered quite a bit. If you think of something else after we are finished today, you can call us back.
I will. I will do that.
We'd be glad to help any way we can.
Okay. I appreciate that so much. And what about you, Jim? Same thing?
I feel the same thing. Okay. You've been so gracious. One thing about my presentation to you, when in getting prepared for this, I tried and tried to think of so many things that I couldn't remember about, and I'm sorry that I couldn't go into more depth in a lot of them because I just don't remember the real details at this age, and I'm sorry.
I thought he did pretty good, too.
I was about to say that anybody who wants to have a sense of the kinds of missions that you were assigned to and that you discharged so honorably in service to this country will find in this interview a terrific resource, and that's absolutely because of the two of you and certainly nothing that I've done except call you up and spend some time with you, which I've been more than happy to do. And, of course, you also very graciously visited us here, too.
Well, we sure enjoyed our visit with
you.
We were quite impressed with the whole setup.
Well, it is an impressive operation.
It is. I had no idea it was out there. And one thing about his memory, I could not remember all the names of those people if that had happened. Or the names of the towns.
I tell you.
I couldn't have done that.
He's really done a terrific job. Well, on that note, I'll go ahead and conclude our interview for today.